some of my songs I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Makes him feel mellow.
Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's February 8th, 2011. Tonight's show is about the Deans of Beer. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43. My co-host tonight, Ray Dieter from TBA Bars. How you doing, Ray?
I'm all right, man. I'm getting excited for tonight's festivities.
So we have a big party tonight at DBA Bar. It's
absolutely.
50th show of the Beer Sessions Radio, and a big shout-out to all the other great hosts on the Heritage Radio Network, many of whom have more than 50 shows. In fact, I think we're one of the newcomers to this network.
Yeah, but who's counting anyway?
And Patrick Martins, he's the guy that founded Heritage Radio Network. He's from Heritage Foods USA. He's going to be there. In fact, we're going to give him a ride over. His two dogs are going to come in our car. That's pretty wild.
Well, that's going to be fun.
But bringing it back to beer, we'll give a shout-out to GreatBrewers.com, our sponsor. It's a culmination of information from passionate beer wholesalers who serve 50,000 beer retailers in 14 states. Check out the latest updates for Beer Cloud, a mobile app to help you locate your favorite beers. Check out GreatBrewers.com, and we're supported by the people at the Good Beer Seal, an association of 27 New York City good beer bars. Check out GoodBeerSeal.com. Well, we've got some really great guests tonight. If you want to email a question in, it's beersessions@gmail.com, or you can call in 718-497-2128. We've got our regular roving reporter, Dave Broderick, down from Vermont.
How you doing, Jimmy?
And there's Joe Lipa from Merchant Devin, and a very special guest who I call the Dean of Beer, Robert Hotson. How are you, Robert?
Doing good, Jimmy.
Robert, what is your official position?
I'm the sales and marketing manager at Union Beer Distributors. And so my primary responsibility is managing our portfolio of craft and specialty beers.
So every beer that I like, you've helped pick out. Is that true?
I suppose so.
For 20 years.
There's some beers that I bet you like
that
we don't
carry. Some of the beers
we
don't like.
Yeah.
Well, most days it's yours. How did you ever get started? We had this interview before, but I think everyone should hear it again. What was your first job in beer?
I was with a company called Mooch and Muck.
I was actually there. I saw it.
Yeah, that was
me too.
It was not pretty.
those were the days.
Yeah, those were the days. But you know, Mooch and Muck, they were primarily a non-alcoholic beverage distributor at the time, through a series of opportunities, they got involved in craft and specialty beer, selling beers like Wild Goose, La Chouffe, Brazal from Canada, a couple of the beers like that, and. You know, it just evolved. I left Mooch and Muck to get on board with Perry's Majestic and Post Road Brewing. Was a regional manager for them in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, and New York. And after that, moved on to the Brooklyn Brewery. And today I'm with Union Beer. So it's been a long, strange trip.
Well, I know that some of my favorite beers that I drink or you help select or bring to the portfolio. What are some that you're most proud of having brought into distributorship?
You know, it's I've really had a hand in bringing a lot of really good beers to the portfolio. And then I work with my colleague Paul Bazier. He and I really sort of lead that charge in identifying brands and seeking them out. But for me, you know, if you get right down to it, there's a couple there that I really, really enjoy. Firestone Walker, Green Flash, Ale Smith. You know, those are a couple. Trogues has been a really good one, Full Sail. I mean, I can go on and on. It's the best part of my job. It's identifying those brands, visiting the breweries, talking to the people, and bringing them to New York.
So, Robert, do you go actually and seek the beer, or do people come to you?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, we get literally, I get calls, I get emails, I get samples sent to me almost on a daily basis. And believe it or not, as large as our portfolio is, we probably turn down three times as many beers as we bring in to the market. But it's a little combination of both. I mean, we target some brands, and some brands target us.
So just for our listeners, I mean, Union Beer has everything from Chimay, you know, some of the other classic Belgian beers, Sam Smith, mm-hmm. Duvel,
Yep, Orval. We carry almost all the Trappist beers. Rochefort, you know, Chimay.
Orval.
Yeah. You name it. We just have just a phenomenal portfolio. I can go on and on and on.
But Union Beer, it's not just in New York, is it? You're all over the East Coast as far as
well,
I know.
Well, Union Beer is just in New York. We are a 14-county wholesaler covering Long Island all the way up to the Lower Hudson Valley. But we have sister companies under the Elknife and Son umbrella. And so through Elknife, we have operations in 9 states now, with statewide coverage in New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Wisconsin, Virginia, Maryland, D.C. So it's a pretty extensive network.
So you're like the evil empire of good beer.
I don't know about the evil empire. We are a good beer empire. We're very, very passionate about promoting the category, driving the sales of the category, bringing good beer. I mean, you know, the person who really had the idea and the concept for greatbrewers.com and Beer Cloud was hired by me a couple years back as just a sales representative.
And that's
Eric McKay. And so, you know, we feel like at Union Beer anyways, and even the other Elknife companies, we try and innovate and do things that you wouldn't expect from regular wholesalers.
So one of the companies that you work with is Merchant Devin.
Yeah.
Right? We got Joe Lipa here.
Known Joe Lipa for many, many years, and he's one of the best relationships I have in the business. You know, I won't tell you how long we've known each other because it'd give away our age, but he's one of the best business partners we have, and I think he thinks the same of us, but he can tell you that.
What makes Union Beer, and particularly Robert, is, and why many could answer your question, right, is why a lot of importers, breweries seek out Union Beer's distribution system, not just in New York, but in other markets. We have them in almost all their markets, as far as Wisconsin, is because they put a management process on it. It's not that easy to manage beers like this where it's maybe 10% of your total volume is in this segment. A lot of distributors just flirt with it. That's not what Union Beer, particularly Mr. Hodson. They're not flirting.
And also Union Beer, I got to say, their sales force, the guys that are actually on the street
them.
Every day, they know their stuff.
And like I said, that's the key to it, is they're trained. Their salespeople are trained, and it's all good.
So what's going on with you, Joe? You've been working with the Sam Smith brand a lot more this year than in the years past.
Not really,
no?
But no, it's our biggest brand in our portfolio. What we felt was important in the craft beer movement is the American craft brewers have done a wonderful job of putting beer on the map, particularly in the United States. I mean, when I first started, I think there was 33 breweries in the United States, and I think there's 1,800 now, and it grows every minute. But we felt that it was necessary to get Sam Smith's word out. Sam Smith was brought to the United States in 1978, way before a lot of this has been going on. So what we're doing this year is we've come up with a Samuel Smith salute, and it's to honor the brewery that launched the craft beer revolution, literally. There was nobody doing it in this format, producing traditional styles of beer. Many of the craft brewers today will emulate Samuel Smith's beers, consider them to be the benchmarks of many of the products. So we felt it was important that we position Samuel Smith where it belongs, and from a marketing point of view. And it goes on. We've never seen a bad day with Samuel Smith. 30 years and 30 years of increases. It's remarkable that you could do this, particularly when I think I said this in the last show, we were the first oatmeal stout. We revitalized the style, was out of existence for 150 years, and I think there's over 100 oatmeal stouts produced today in the United States by American craft brewers.
Wow.
So it's interesting.
So this is the Samuel Smith oatmeal
stout.
Yeah,
we're tasting the oatmeal, tasting the one that, it's our largest seller. But Smith's gone into a lot of different, this is why they can reinvent themselves, and it's very hard to do this you know, for 250 years is to reinvent the wheel. I always kind of get a charge when someone says, oh, this is a great brewery, and I said, you're not a great brewery when you've been in business for 5 years. When you've been around for 250 years or 300 years, then we can talk about what's a great brewery.
And I've been out to that brewery. It's really beautiful. I mean, it's just majestic and looks like it's been there for 250 years.
They're doing, I was there last week, and it's incredible. They're just doing the same damn thing they were doing 250 years. They're still fermenting in slate. They're the only brewery in the world. Still slate squares.
The Yorkshire squares.
Still delivering beer by horses in Tadcaster.
Yeah, I saw the horses.
It's incredible.
Mm, this, I mean, and this is great. The we're drinking the oatmeal stout, and it really is a lovely, lovely beer. Yeah. I remember when I first met Paul Schlossberg. No, I'm sorry, Pete Schlossberg.
God bless him.
And he based his Pete's Wicked Ale on
brown ale.
On your stuff. Yep.
Yeah, he went around to sales meetings, and he had to see him, a bottle of Sam Smith in his hand, and he basically said, you know, this is what I'm trying to emulate. Mm-hmm. I can't stone slate ferment, but this is, I'm going to get close to it.
I believe it was your nut brown.
It was the nut brown, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think Sam Smith, for me, it's, you know, today there's so many beers available to beer lovers. I mean, everywhere you turn, there's a new beer, a new style. Black IPAs are the rage right now, it seems like. But to me, I think there's so many offerings that people often forget how good some beers are. And they say, oh, I've had Sam Smith, but I haven't had it in a long time. And there was a one point when they tried it, it was the greatest beer they've ever had in their life. And with so many offerings, they kind of forget. And the thing about my portfolio is I'll come back to a Sam Smith every couple of years, a certain one, and wonder why I haven't drank it more. It's just a phenomenal beer. It's a classic. And it's one of those beers people, if they went back to Sam Smith, if they haven't had it in a while, they'd remember what brought them to the category in the first place.
They're classics. And also, I'm really glad that they're serving it now in brown glass, too. The bottles are brown, as opposed to the clear glasses like it used to be served.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, Jim.
It's great when you come down. We got an awesome show tonight. We got some secret guests calling in later. But what do you have you had a, and do you have any good stories about Sam Smith?
I have a great Sam Smith story. I was on my tour around the country visiting breweries in my Airstream, and Bob Sylvester of St. Somewhere down in Florida recommended this town called Cedar Key. He said it's like Florida in the 40s, and you got to go up there and check it out. And so I did, and there was this old dive hotel on the beach, and I went in there, and the only beer they had, and this is in the middle of nowhere. I mean, this town literally was like the 1940s, was Sam Smith. They had like four bottles of Sam Smith. So I sat there for 4 days and drank nothing but Sam Smith. And, you know, it was like 90 degrees, and it was still some of the best beer I've ever had. So it was a great moment.
So Joe, when are we going to get some Sam Smith draft beer?
Never. I just went through. It's just, they are, they're traditional. One thing, the Smith family will not compromise quality over anything. I mean, they...
No draft, no casks?
Joe, have I ever asked for draft beer for Sam Smith?
About once every hour.
Yeah.
It would be interesting if we had it. I mean, we talk about it all the time, say what, you know, what this thing would be if Samuel Smith...
Well, a couple of months ago, we were lucky enough to have Sam Smith the Seventh as a guest on the radio, and we really did like hold him to the wall trying to get some draft product from him, and he seemed to be very agreeable to that. So when he takes over the reins of power at the brew house, maybe we'll have a change of heart. What do you think?
Well, I'll cross our fingers.
Okay.
It's like I said, it's a very interesting thing. You mentioned about the clear glass. This is very interesting. We were in clear glass, as you know,
for years, and
here's how we did it. It was because you're going back to 1978 where people thought that was dark beer, your amber beer.
He's pointing to a glass of amber beer.
That's right.
If
it was yellow beer. We did it because we had the colors of the beers were perfect. It allowed us to talk about the types of malts in the products. It was an educational component and a visual to say, no, this is not dark. This is dark beer. Oatmeal stout is dark beer. Brown ale is not dark beer.
Right.
Pale ale is not dark. That's the reason why we did it.
That makes a lot of sense. Up front, it makes a lot of sense as far as marketing and so forth and giving the information out there by eyesight. Yeah. Yeah, Jimmy.
Cool, man. We're going to take a short break here. Beer Sessions Radio. We'll be back in a few minutes.
me feel so good. And I wouldn't live without her, even if I could. They call her different than the way she looked before. I call her back.
Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We're sponsored by GreatBrewers.com and supported by TheGoodBeerSeal.com. We've got some really great guests, and we just had a special guest walked in, a Heritage Radio Network host and an Edible Manhattan, Edible Brooklyn reporter.
Hello.
Rachel Warden. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
You know, Rachel heard that Joe Lipa from Merchant Devin was here, and she's like, I have a question for you, and she's here. What did you want to ask Joe?
Two questions about Samuel Smith. Number one is, what happens if Samuel Smith VII has a daughter? And number two, what is stone slate fermenting?
That first question is very interesting. If he has a daughter, and there,
I don't know.
There's two brothers, Humphrey and Oliver, and Oliver's got all girls on his side. So you can see where the succession
is. How old is Samuel then, the seventh?
He's 22.
Okay, he's got some time to work this out.
We've had discussions with him about this, and I'm sure he's being schooled on this right
what
now.
What about Samantha Smith? That works for me.
Samantha. Yeah.
Or Sammy with an IE.
There you go.
Answer your question about stone slate fermentation is, this brewery has these open fermenters that are made out of stone slate. There were other breweries that did this up in northern Yorkshire area. This was kind of the brewing, the way you brewed beer up there. The cost of doing it is so prohibitive. It takes two people to clean it in like 48 hours to clean these things up. I mean, there's over 100 of them. And so a lot of breweries it was so time-consuming and so expensive, they just stopped doing it. The more important thing, it does impart a certain flavor to Samuel Smith's beers. That's why they are what they are. You'll always find out with Samuel Smith's beers, they're always made by the strict definition of the style, and they're always in balance.
You can taste
that fermentation process.
You can taste that mineralness, mineralicity,
yeah,
if that's a word.
Yep, exactly.
No, and they're actually dug down, right? It's like it's in the ground, or
no, they're up.
They're up.
They're up. They're up. They're up. But they're hard. They haven't built one now, and God. A long, long time.
Mm-hmm. Yorkshire Squares.
Yorkshire Squares, the only brewery that does it. And it's like I said, it's very expensive, but it is part of the character of Sam Smith.
Cool. I want to go back to Robert Hodson because Robert, in addition, I'm going to keep playing this up. I really think you're a big reason there's so many good beers in New York City.
Thank you.
And I love all the brands you bring in. Are there any up-and-coming, real small, like, nanobreweries or super microbreweries that you're loving these days?
There's two. And there's more than that, but I'll talk about two that we recently brought to New York. The first one is Hill Farmstead, who we're going to be talking about soon, so I won't steal any thunder there. But all I'll say is phenomenal, phenomenal liquid. Here's a guy, Sean Hill, who's very passionate, understand the brewing process, understands the ingredients. He's a phenomenal brewer, and we're really excited to have him aboard. The second one is a brewery out of New Hampshire, Hooks at New Hampshire, called White Birch. And for me, the interesting thing about White Birch is when you taste those beers, you can't expect to taste a classic triple in his triple. You can't expect to taste a classic double in his double. You have to sort of think outside the box. He brews according to what he feels, and what he really wants and what he perceives as a really ideal flavor character. And I think that's, I think, in my opinion, that's the way a lot of breweries are sort of heading. He's moving a little bit quicker pace, and he's sort of redefining what it means stylistically for certain beers, and I think it's very exciting. And so it's tough to sort of wrap your head around some of his beers, but I think they're all very exciting, and I get a kick out of drinking them.
We've got a special guest on the phone. It's Sean Hill from Hill Farmstead Brewery. He just called in because he wanted to talk to Robert, and his buddy Dave Broderick's here. How you doing, Sean?
I'm okay.
You're okay. I'm going to turn this over to Dave.
You don't sound okay.
You guys are the ones drinking beer. I'm just drinking a glass of Fafoon. I'll probably be better in a few minutes. It's nice having Cantillon on tap at home, though.
Cantillon on tap at home. Wow.
It's nice having a brewery at home, too.
I want to go to your house.
Yeah, come by.
Well, we're drinking one of your beers, Sean. Dave, what beer did you pour for us?
We've got the his Fear and Trembling. It's the Cabernet.
The smoked porter.
The French?
Yes, the French.
Sweet.
So you want to describe for us that what exactly that beer is?
Yeah, it's a true Baltic porter. That was a guest brew. My former boss, Anders Kissmeyer, came through. In April, and he personally smoked a malt here on our little kind of ghetto red smoker over maple wood, and then we retrieved some lager yeast and fermented it as if it was a true Baltic porter. The only difference is that it wasn't brewed adjacent to the Baltic Sea. And then we decided to do three different barrel treatments. French oak Cabernet, American oak Cabernet, and then we managed to get some empty Utopias barrels from Sam Adams. Then we released the three different versions simultaneously. Intended to be kind of an educational event for people so they could taste the difference. Same beer, different barrels.
Now, you're a real small brewery. How much stuff did you produce? How many bottles are there?
Of that, what is there? I think there was about 300 bottles of each of those releases.
Wow, that is a tiny amount. That makes it very special.
So, Sean, between the French oak Cabernet and the American oak Cabernet, is there any particular difference that each one of those barrels brings to the beer?
Yeah, of course. I mean, actually, French oak, as you guys probably know from drinking great wines, is less vanilla forward. There's no vanillin in French oak or Hungarian oak as there is in American oak, which we all know from drinking bourbon. So actually, when we're blending those beers and tasting them, we decided that the French oak was probably the best on its own, and that the American oak barrel didn't really. Yeah, that's the head cheese. Yeah, go ahead.
Cool.
Sorry. Sorry, our local meat curing guy dropped off some head cheese, which I'd never had before. It was pretty amazing. So we actually decided that the American oak Cabernet barrel didn't really express itself as much as we had hoped. So we ended up blending the Utopias barrel with that American oak barrel to sort of create a more American style forward vanilla. Style beer.
Sean, where are you from?
I'm from Greensboro, Vermont.
Wow. And where did you start to learn brewing?
Greensboro, Vermont.
And why are you selling beer in New York? You're so small. Why don't you just sell all your beer up there in Vermont?
I did only sell beer here first because
I asked him.
Dave dragged it down here.
Yeah, Dave probably has something to do with that a little bit, but I guess we also sell a very small amount of beer to Philadelphia too. It's sort of based, originally my business plan was to try to only sell my beer in Vermont only. But I wanted to be a Vermont only brewery, but I think.
But the world came knocking at your door.
What's that?
The world came knocking at your door.
Yeah, actually it has.
That's great.
You're being, not just figurative, but very literal. I guess probably because I think that people there would appreciate it in some cases more than some people here. You know, I mean, it is, it's something different to every person, of course, depending on what level of the beer pathway you're on. But
cool, Sean. Yeah. Hold on, I'm gonna ask Dave. When did you first meet Sean? Sean Hill.
I actually met him at the Vermont Brewers Fest when he was working at the Shed. And
what's the Shed?
The Shed is a brewery in Stowe.
Okay.
I think they, Sean, don't they have open fermenters there at the Shed?
They do. Yeah. And I brought in one little tiny closed fermenter to do all those fun beers.
Yeah, and it was the first time that I had Shed beer and I actually liked it. So I knew that was I knew that was a step in the right direction.
It's the first time you liked it or first time you had it and liked it?
First time.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. No, first I'd had it plenty of times before. And so it was funny. We just started hanging out by his booth and didn't want to leave. And that's where it started. And then he started his went up to Trout River and started his sojourn to where he is now.
And then when did Robert Hodson first meet you, Sean?
As far as I recall, that would have been in, I think you guys came out in May?
Yeah, around May, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, like mid-May.
Took a long drive. I mean, a long drive.
out to see. But, I mean, that's what Union does. I mean, they made the effort to you flew up to Burlington, right? And then
flew to Burlington, got into a
car, and then drove all the way to Sean's doorstep and tasted his beers and tried to sign him on.
Yeah, couldn't find him. Luckily, somehow we ran into his cousin, I think, who steered us in the right direction. He was the one person we saw in the area. Literally the one person. And we pulled over and asked him. He said, "Oh, it's my cousin. He's right up the road there. Take a left." And
I think Sean's
the hill.
The road's named after Sean, so I think he's related to quite a few people up there.
I would imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, there's an ongoing joke about me having to be careful who I date in the local area. But
it's a small town.
Sean, how many generations have you been on that farm?
Well, this particular farm, I'm only the fourth generation. But because my great-great-great-grandfather moved down the hill from the adjacent property in the 1870s, so like the abutting property would go back six, and then but I'm the eighth in Greensboro, so they kind of migrated from like Caspian Lake area and then I guess maybe when the town hit like 300 people or something, they decided it was too populated for them. There's like this natural kind of misanthropic tendency, I think, amidst all hills. Mm-hmm. So then they decided to move even further into the boondocks.
And you name a lot of your beers after your ancestors.
Yep, exactly. That is true.
And including the Abner. And
yep.
And which ancestor is that?
Grandfather. No, great-grandfather. Edward is my grandfather.
Wait, let us know what styles of beers they are, too. So you got Abner, and what's that?
So our flagship, I don't like that word, but everybody knows what it means, is Edward. That's our American Pale Ale. That was my grandfather. And then there's sort of this trilogy series which goes grandfather, great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather. And Abner was Edward's father, and that's also our double IPA, which is literally, the recipe is literally a double Edward. And then there's a beer called Ephraim, which is my great-great-grandfather, which is our really large 10 to 10.5%, you know, 270 theoretical IBU Imperial IPA, which is literally triple the hop profile of Edward. Those beers, I love all those beers. I mean, people love them. I think they're probably all honored somewhere.
So Edward, Abner, and Ephraim.
Yep, exactly.
All right.
Well done.
And who was the famous, who was the only president from Vermont?
Yeah, wasn't that like
that would be Calvin Coolidge.
Coolidge, yeah, Coolidge.
You don't know, Sean?
Dude, I don't pay attention to politics.
You only know your own family history. You must be in the boondocks.
philosophy, family history.
Well, that's cool.
So I got a question for you. You're barrel aging this stuff in the French oak, the American oak, and what was the other one?
Utopias,
right.
which is a spent Buffalo Trace bourbon barrel,
right from Sam Adams.
Yep.
How long do you age that stuff? How long does it sit in that barrel?
I mean, you know, we have many barrels, and the aging profile depends upon the base beer and sort of maybe like tasting the beer every 2 weeks. In this particular example, those beers went into the barrel in the very end of April, so May, June, July, August, September. Those beers are only about 5 months.
The ones that you bottled?
Those Fear and Tremblings, yeah.
Okay.
Hold on one second. There's something going on here that our listeners may not know, but there's a huge trend going on. And Sean, you're an extremely small brewery, and I first learned about it from Dave Broderick. Dave, tell us a little more about what's going on with Sean Hill and Lawson's Finest and some of these other guys.
Well, it's just, you know, I mean, some people call it the nano brewery movement or the super small brewery movement, but you know, it's production breweries that are, you know, in the old days couldn't have made any money. They were so small, and now, thanks to the better appreciation, they can. And so you find people like Sean starting these much smaller breweries in these remote locations, and getting to follow their dreams. So, I mean, Sean, do you consider? I mean, now you're growing so fast, but do you still consider yourself part of that movement, or
you know,
have you already
actually,
left it behind?
I actually never really considered myself part of that movement. I think because we started with a 7-barrel system. Like, I think maybe my remote location, like, makes me sort of feel something similar to it. But, like, you know, there are so many people that are doing 4 barrels and smaller.
Yeah, 7 barrels is gigantic. It's massive.
compared to Lawson, yeah, absolutely. I don't know. I mean, I feel like every week now, I'm talking to a brewer, receiving an email from a brewer who's really jazzed about his 1-barrel system that he's going to like start his brewery on and bottle everything and cork and cage everything and sell his bottles for $20 a bottle.
Has InBev gotten a hold of you yet?
InBev, no. No, we wouldn't sell to those guys.
We got time for one more question before we take a break, Joe.
Sean, this is Joe Lipa from Merchant Divin. I just, you know, Little Reedsboro is very famous for me and fond. I live in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, but the first girl I ever dated was from Reedsboro, Vermont. I think there's 3 girls
Reedsboro.
Up there.
Okay.
Is that your sister?
That's Reedsboro, not Greensboro.
Just one moment, Jimmy. Speaking of small breweries, if people don't know, Traquair House, the oldest inhabited house in Scotland, we just released 800 cases of Traquair 2020. This is a 900-barrel brewery in Scotland. It's, like I said, the oldest inhabited house in Scotland. It's one wooden fermenter in that back room of that brewery, but if you can find it. Robert, how many cases did you guys get from New York?
37.
There's 37 cases of Traquair 2020.
I'll take one.
You got 10 years to drink it, so it's kind of cool.
What's so special about that beer? Why is it called 2020?
Joe, you don't have the headphone on, but he asked, what's so special about the 2020 beer? Why is it called 2020?
It's called 20. Traquair House produces 3 beers. The Traquair House, the Traquair Jacobite Ale, which is their house ale with coriander in it. And then the 2020 was a special release. All their beers have 10-year shelf lives. So we thought it would be kind of cool to release a third beer of theirs. It's a little lighter. It's a little lighter than the Traquair House Ale, but it has, like I said, a 10-year. Actually, you probably can go 10 or more than 10 years.
Sean, stay on there, buddy. We have to take a short break for our.
Some people like oxidation. Some people don't.
We'll be back in a few minutes. Beer Sessions Radio. Stay on the air, Sean.
Ziggy played guitar, jamming good with Webb and Gilly and the Spiders from Mars. He played it left hand, but made it too far. Became the special man, then we were Ziggy's band. Ziggy really sang. Screwed up eyes and screw down hairdo, like some cat from Japan. He could lick 'em by smiling, he could leave 'em to hang.
they came on so loaded, man. Well hung in snow white tan.
Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Thanks to our sponsor, GreatBrewers.com, and to our supporter, Good Beer Seal. We're loaded with special guests tonight, including Sean Hill from Hill Farmstead Brewery in Vermont. How are you, Sean? Are you still with us?
I'm okay. Yeah, I'm doing well.
All right.
How's that head cheese?
It's great, man. Very good.
So, Sean, why don't you tell us, I think I've heard through the grapevine that you might be coming down to New York City in April?
Yeah, I was just talking to Dan about that. We're kind of trying to plot that out. It's really difficult. We're just talking about how most people only want to do beer events in the middle of a week, which is not really the ideal time for a brewer to make a sojourn into the city. So if we make
it,
it'd have
bro.
To be like, what's that?
Jimmy's 43, Saturday night.
Saturday night? Oh, there you
go. I got you.
Tiger on Sunday.
So we're trying to figure out how to get Dan down there as well, so we could both go. But yeah,
and that would be Dan Suarez.
Dan Suarez, indeed.
So, tell us about
formerly
Dan.
Of Six
yeah.
Point.
We know Dan. Dan's a cool guy.
Yes, he is. He's sitting on my floor drinking Beer Geek Brunch and eating head cheese.
What's Beer Geek Brunch?
That is a beer from McKellar made with weasel, I guess we could say weasel dung, coffee that was digested by the civet.
Yep. Weasel you've never dung heard, coffee.
Jimmy looks dumbfounded. You never heard of that?
No, I haven't been in Vermont.
Coffee beans that go through an animal and then you.
But then you what?
Then you roast them and
I'm familiar with all types
and
of
brew. Grind them.
You know, traditional food that's processing.
That's a very,
but no,
very old traditional way of making coffee.
Have you had that?
And then it's a very young way of making beer.
Roadkill beer. Roadkill coffee.
I do have some friends. I'm going to give a shout out to Vermont. I have some really good friends up in Vermont. Les and I can't remember the name.
No, that's
really
good
friends, Jimmy.
Yeah, really close.
Well, they're wild food gatherers. And the key is what they do is I don't know if everybody does this up there, but when you get a roadkill, you pick it up, right, Sean? With roadkill,
oh, yeah.
you pick it up, you use the meat,
the opportunity,
you might tan the
ever.
Hide. Well, they have a fox fur waiting for me, so up there. But I have to go up and get it.
That's good for you, Jimmy.
Yeah, that sounds like really
what's
good.
What's the beer scene like up in Vermont? And Dave, you're up there a lot. You live up there. I mean,
yeah.
The beer's like McKellar. I mean, are those beers being sold in Vermont? You have stores in Vermont to buy beer?
You basically have to go to Sean's
yeah,
brewery to get them.
You pretty much have to come here.
Sean, why don't you tell them about the event that you had on Saturday where you had 14 lines going in your little tap room.
Yeah, so... yeah, basically, you know, there's very little to do in the middle of the winter. Other than maybe cross-country skiing or hanging out inside drinking beer and playing board games. So I decided to try to do some kind of winter beer event, so we managed to round up a bunch of pretty exquisite beers, pre-sold some tickets, had catered food, three
Itchies.
Of the jazz musicians in the state. Played. Jasper Hill was here serving cheese. They're serving Windermere, which is a beer washed cheese that's made with our beer or washed
awesome.
With our beer. And then that day we happened to release a really rare beer that we fermented in oak, which is the first time I'd ever done a primary fermentation in the oak itself. And the Windermere that's being served that day was actually washed with the same beer that we were releasing. So. It all coincided, and Dave was here.
The only time I bartend is when I go to your events. I don't bartend at the Tiger anymore.
Who stops you, Dave? You don't want to, or they just don't let you?
They just don't let me.
I see, yeah. That happens to me,
Sean's
too.
Sean's the only one that lets me.
It would be stressful.
Well, to round out our beer education, and Joe's brought some other beers from Europe. Right now we're drinking the Eyinger Celebrator.
Okay.
Yeah, this is from the... highly acclaimed brewery, Eyinger. Probably, yeah. I don't know if there's a more decorated brewery in the world today, is Eyinger. Every beer that they that they produce is always a world beer champion. Celebrator Doppelbach, is, if there's a better dark lager in the world, I want to know who it is.
Unless you get that really cool little goat on the bottle,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
That was a Merchant of Inn deal.
That was your idea, Joe?
It was collective. It was just to jazz it up a little bit, but they were just the brewery and their wheat beer, and their we released their Weizenbach this year with them. So, yeah, this is a beautiful Bavarian brewery.
Yeah, it's great stuff. I love it on draft too. Celebrator on draft.
I wish we could get more wheat beer on draft. We're trying, but because it would be very interesting.
Joe, how did you ever get hooked up with Eyinger?
Oh, it was one of the originals. Actually, Michael Jackson. Led us to Eyinger, as he led us to Samuel Smith. He wanted to write a book, and he already knew the great breweries, the folklore breweries, and he kind of gave us the template. He's, you know, here you go dancing.
Now, Joe, your company is called Merchant de Vin.
Yes.
And that's the sellers of wine.
Yeah, the company originally started as a wine company. Charlie Finkel, who started the company, was actually the national sales manager for Chateau St. Michel Wines. Mm-hmm. And he left that and started Merchant de Vin. Looking for wine.
So it's kind of ironic. You're exercising irony here.
We left the name for a couple of reasons. One was the original name, but the more important thing was back once again in 1978, these were beers sold like wine.
Mm-hmm.
Styles of beer.
Right.
Merchant of Inn is still the only company that really, really, really stays in that vogue of styles of beer.
Whoa. Rob Hodgson just baptized.
Cracking
our vowel, and it just went all over the place.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know,
Joe, the funny thing is, I remember in the 90s, I used to buy your beer and resell it at my first restaurant. I always got that. To me, Merchant Event made a lot of sense that you always had a really good beer in bottle. The name was great. I think it's a great name.
We connected to the food. We were the first company that connected to the food industry. Robert Hodgson was a living proof of that when he worked for Brooklyn Brewery, who was a distributor in town. When we were partnering with Brooklyn at that time, the word Brooklyn and even in New York was not so cool. And Robert could attest to that. And actually, Merchant of Inn opened up the doors for Brooklyn Brewery to bring their beers in. And, of course, they were very good beers. And course, later, now Brooklyn was helping Merchant of Inn. It became a big partnership to do that. One thing I'll say about Mr. Hodgson here, my good friend, is he like us, are passionate. And Dave, same thing. Either you're in or you're out. It's a lifestyle. And I think this is why Robert has been so successful cultivating the New York City market, because it's his passion. You know, there's nothing he doesn't know. And we talk all the time, and I always call him up, and we always
even if he has to make it up.
He makes it up
with the best of them. I can tell you that.
Well, you always have to do that, Robert, with Republicans.
Sean, I'm going to give you a chance. Sean, I would like you to ask be our guest question. Ask Robert Hodgson a question about how he got started, or something like that.
Oh, I thought you were going to say ask him a question that you think he probably doesn't know the answer to.
That's,
that's better.
That's
not fair, because Sean can ask a lot of questions that won't know
easy.
The answer to.
Trans to non and all. Robert, go.
Yeah, that's a long word with four syllables, I think.
Nailed it.
Five syllables, I'm sorry.
That's better than I would have done.
Well, I don't know. What can I ask Robert?
Four more questions, Sean. That was a good one.
No. No, I think for Sean and I mean, you know, when I met Sean, it was, you know, you could tell right away that he was. I met a lot of brewers, a lot of guys who are passionate about beer, but Sean sort of stands alone in that, in his passion, his understanding, his knowledge. He's got great experience. I mean, I knew right away, and of course, when you taste his beers, I don't think. You know, there's a lot of breweries who brew one, two, three really, really, really good beers. I haven't had a beer from Sean that I didn't think was fantastic. I think it speaks volumes about his talents and his abilities. And I think he's just got a tremendous amount of success, a really bright future in front of him. It's an honor to distribute his beers. I can say
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I really appreciate how clean his beers are. Like each style is just it's just some of the cleanest beers you're ever going to get. And I was sitting at the Three Penny on Sunday watching the Super Bowl, drinking Pacifica, which was, I think, 5.2, Sean, something like that.
Yeah. Yep.
And it was just so great to have a beer that's only 5.2. I felt like I could keep drinking it all night long and still drive home.
Only 5.2.
That had, like, so much flavor, you know. It was just so, and everybody, we kicked the keg, you know, while I was sitting there, which was very disappointing. And so
not for Sean, it wasn't.
Not for Sean. It was great for Sean, because then another one went on, but it wasn't Pacifica.
You guys have such a wild life up there. It's almost like, let's bring it back to Belgium. We got Joe.
Dude, now, it was 38 below.
how many inches of snow, guys?
I've got 4 feet on my lawn.
Yeah, I would say just about that. You know, I think I swear every day and bitch about how California brewers have no integrity, because they don't have to deal with like their glycol chiller freezing or moving kegs around outside.
What is that got to do with integrity?
I don't know. It has a lot to do with, I don't know, maybe
it's
all about shooting.
It's all about suffering.
It's all about suffering, man.
It always is.
So, Joe's going to tell us a little bit about another really unique and interesting beer.
One of a kind, actually. Orval Trap East, one of the seven of the Trappist breweries in the world that produce beer. This is one of a kind in that there's no beer in the world that tastes like it. There is nothing. No one's even gotten close to it yet. And a lot of craft brewers have tried. Not happening. There's a lot of breweries now using Wild Brett.
Right,
but
right.
Not like this. It's got on the label, it has a 5-year shelf life. Most people in Belgium drink it about 2.5 years. And one misnomer about Trappist beers is consumers and people think that Trappist is a style of beer. Trappist is not a style of beer. A Trappist brewery could produce Bud Light. You know, they can produce any style they want to produce. Trappist means that the brewery is inside the walls of the monastery. Okay, all the production's in the monastery. There's no outside financial funding that comes to the monastery. It's all self-funded, and the majority of the profits go to charity.
Right. InBev doesn't have anything to do with any of the Trappist breweries.
No. These are all secular, and they're all their own. The monasteries do their own thing. It's not also why they all make great beer. The biggest one being Chimay, as we all know Chimay, which is a great one. All those breweries are great because they, once again, it's the passion. It's the quality of the beers that they do. They happen to be Trappist, but even if they didn't have the Trappist seal on them, they'd still be...
Joe, I've got a question about Orval. Orval is the only, as far as I know, the only Trappist ale that... There's only one. There's Orval. It's the one, kind of an English-style hoppy ale.
Yeah.
And, I mean, all the other guys have
doubles
and triples and all that kind of stuff. But Orval is Orval. And I actually had a cask of Orval. Not here in New York, no. I was in Belgium at a beer festival, and there was a wooden barrel of Orval.
Really?
It was amazing.
Wow.
My friend John Hansel from the Malt Advocate, he dragged me over there by my ear. He's like, Ray, you've got to taste this. And
I had Orval in the brewery. They have a little room, a tasting room, and I had Orval 2 weeks ago on draft at the brewery, but there's nothing commercial.
I wasn't even going to go there.
because it just wouldn't be the same beer. They'll never do it, but they might have flirted with it.
This is about 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah. Westmalle does draft, limited amount now, double.
Huh?
Yeah. There's
really?
Westmalle double and draft in Belgium.
Can we talk about this after the show?
Yeah. You can write a letter. Yeah. But Orval is special. I mean, if you saw the email trail to Orval in our company, people know it. This is special. This is one of a kind.
Do they do other styles?
Nothing. Okay. This is the beauty of you talk about having a business model. Chimay does about 165,000 hectoliters of beer.
No, they're massive.
They're big. Well, they're not big, but big for Trappist.
Compared to Sean.
Yeah, with seven. But this is what's interesting, and they produce different styles of beer, right? They doubles and triples. And Westmalle is the second largest at 125,000, and they do double and triple. Mm-hmm. The third largest brewery at 65,000 hectoliters is this beer, one bottle, one beer. This is the people's beer in Belgium. If you really, really look and go into Belgium, and you go into the pubs, you go down south, it's all Chimay because they're down south. You go up north, it's all Westmalle. But you go everywhere in Belgium, this is the people's beer.
And how strong is this beer?
6.9.
So it's not terribly strong. It's not crazy strong.
But it's not weak either.
No, it's not. No, it's got some balls. No.
But it's
the longer it stays, the Belgians. Absolutely. I drank a Norval 2 weeks ago that was less than 6 weeks old.
Hmm.
And the Belgians, although it says 5 years, best served before 5 years, the Belgians, the majority of the Belgians, want to drink this beer in 2 years. They like it younger.
I'm a big fan of fresh beer.
And the cool thing is that all those bars
years ago, I used to collect every
Batsman
to send me a bottle. I have a whole collection of Laval.
Keep going, Sean. Keep going.
Oh, I was going to say the cool thing is that most bars in Belgium, you can choose between one-year-old Orval or fresh Orval, and it only costs like 20 or 30 euro cent more for the one-year-old Orval, which is brilliant. So good.
Cool.
No, I never noticed that in my trips to Belgium. We had a choice like that.
What did you say, Sean?
I was just saying that a lot of bars in Belgium offer you a choice between fresh Orval and one-year-old Orval.
Oud Orval.
Yeah.
Yes. They have a program called the Ambassador Program in Belgium where they've chosen certain pubs, and they're in that program where they serve different vintages of Orval. And, yes, they age the Oud Orval. I had a 12-year-old.
What happens to the flavor over a
year? It gets drier.
It's drier.
I'm not a fan of a 12-year-old Orval. It's my palate.
So I should buy this bottle and then just let it sit around for a year as a consumer?
You could go five.
And then compare it. And then compare it to a fresh bottle.
Yeah, you'll know it gets drier. What's happening is the yeast is going after that sugar and just accentuates drier.
So it's bottle conditioned, obviously.
So, Sean, when do you think this fear and trembling that we have here and that some of us have in our cellars, when do you think we should, how long do you think we should age it, if at all?
Oh, man, that's a great question. I don't know. I mean, listen to you guys talking about Orval aging and 12-year-old Orvals or 5-year-old Traqueurs, et cetera, et cetera. It's all a matter of personal taste. Personally, like especially with barrel aged beer, when it's released, typically it's ready to be consumed. It's already been aged by the brewer in an oxidative environment, like an oak barrel, so it's already sort of accelerated. It's totally up to consumer's discretion. But typically, personally, the only beers that I've ever had that are great beyond 1 or 2 years are lambics. Having drank like Cantillons from the 70s, they're brilliant. They're so good.
They are.
I'm not a fan of oxidation. I'm hypersensitive to it. So typically the moment that cardboard starts to interplay with hops, I just dump the beer down the drain. But that's personal preference.
So that Fafoon you're drinking right now is pretty good.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yes, it is.
We're all lucky to have great deans of beer like Robert Hodson and Joe Lipa and Dave Broderick, who is responsible for bringing so many beers into New York, all three of them. We're just going to give a little shout-out, Good Beer Seal Events. Tonight, Rattle and Hum has Blue Point Brewing taking over the taps. Wednesday, February 9th, is the Omegang event at Blind Tiger. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
How are the new events going, Dave, at Blind Tiger? You've changed it up a little bit.
I changed it up. It's the Curator Series, so they're a little smaller, 14 beers generally, and we try to sort of pick and choose and come up with a theme for the event. So far, so good.
Awesome. And check this out, Saturday, February 12th. This is a pretty cool event. Swift Bar is hosting a comprehensive tasting of beers from Trappist breweries. They did this last year. It's pretty cool. It's their all Trappist event. Check it out and go to goodbeerseal.com for more events. In closing, I'd like to thank our sponsors at greatbrewers.com. And the Beer Sessions Radio is supported by the Good Beer Seal. Thanks to Ray, Robert, Joe, Rachel, and Dave for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni, and thanks to our producers, Jack Insley and Bree O'Connor. We'll see you next time
on
Beer Sessions Radio. Thanks, Sean.
I casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me.